For most of us, lying down for sleep at the end of a long day is something we look forward to. Maybe we worry about the events of the day or have a little insomnia. Maybe we snuggle with a loved one or read a bit before turning out the light. But for some of us, the night is a realm of dread, and sleep is but a portal to terror. Because when some of us go to sleep, we awake to a terrible presence in the room. Perhaps we can't see it, but we know it's there. We feel these things crawl into our bed, and we're paralyzed and unable to fight back as we feel something climb on top of us and press us down into the bed. It's reported around the world, across cultures, across time. Maybe it's happened to you. It's happened to me. But in this episode of Monster Talk, we'll be talking to someone who can tell us what's really going on. And maybe, just maybe, the night can become a safe place again.
It's actually quite unlike anything we've ever seen before.
A giant, hairy creature, part ape, part man.
In Loch Ness, a 24-mile-long bottomless lake in the highlands of Scotland, it's a creature known as the Loch Ness Monster.
Monster Talk.
On this episode of Monster Talk, we welcome Dr. Brian Sharpless, co-author of an upcoming book on one of the most fascinating phenomena that I have experienced myself, sleep paralysis. The book is titled Sleep Paralysis, Historical, Psychological, and Medical Perspectives. Dr. Sharpless is an assistant professor of psychology at Washington State University. His studies focus on anxiety and unusual and rare psychological disorders, and of course, sleep paralysis. It's due to be published July 21st and is available for pre-order on Amazon.com. We'll have a link to that in our show notes. Welcome to Monster Talk, Brian. I didn't mention it in the intro, but you're also a listener?
Yes. It's an honor to be on the 99th show. Thanks for having me.
Welcome. So sleep paralysis as a phenomena offers a naturalistic explanation for a broad array of allegedly paranormal phenomena. But before we get into that, can you tell us a little bit about what science has discovered about the phenomena of sleep itself?
Oh, well, it's still very mysterious in a lot of ways, but one of the things we found out is that a lot of interesting things happen when it goes wrong. So sleep paralysis is when you're either going to sleep or you're waking up and you find yourself unable to move. So you're paralyzed, except for your eyes, and you can still breathe. But the strange thing is you have conscious awareness, and about 90% of people have dreams, but they're having them while they're awake. So what you have are aspects of REM sleep that are superimposed with wakefulness. So you've got the paralysis of REM, which is presumably so that we don't act out our dreams, because that'd be pretty terrifying. And then we've got the weird dream imagery that goes on during REM sleep. So you have both of those, but while you're awake and able to look around the room, but you can't move.
So I guess, could we start off with some definitions? What is a dream and how is it different from a nightmare?
Well, a dream is a broader term. Nightmares are by definition scary. And in sleep paralysis, they're scarier at a much higher percentage than normal dreams. There's something about the experience itself that really lends itself to a negative and a scary valence.
Is sleep paralysis fairly normal? I mean, how much of the population do you think it affects?
Yeah, I did a study on that. I combined one of my studies with 35 other studies. So we had a really large sample of 36,000 people. And it was pretty shocking how common it was. About 8% of the population has experienced it at least once. And the rates go up if you're a student, it's about 28%. And if you're a psychiatric patient, it's 32%. So it's really a common experience.
Why is it more common amongst students?
My guess would be with them and psychiatric patients that they have more disrupted sleep, which is one of the predisposing factors that makes it more likely. So they're cramming, they have unusual sleep cycles, they might be drinking more. And all of these things can make you more likely to have sleep paralysis.
Right.
Yeah.
And pregnancy too, I must say, Karen.
Oh, we're going to get to that.
Yeah.
We're going to get to that.
What So what kind of cultural explanations for this phenomena What kind of cultural explanations for this phenomenon?
That's the singular. Phenomena is plural.
Have you seen from the historical research? How does this manifest now, and how do people think about it in earlier times?
Sure. Well, people have been writing about it since at least the time of ancient Greece. That's the earliest I've been able to come up with. And what's amazing is that it seems to be a universal phenomenon. Yeah, I got that right. See? But it seems to be a universal phenomenon.
And now you won't get angry letters. Congratulations.
I'll get them. Believe me, I get enough. When people hear that I'm saying that these things aren't caused by real alien abductions, they get very upset with me.
Oh,
but
yeah.
It seems to be interpreted culturally in very different ways. So I collected a list of about 108 terms from different times and places. And some of the highlights are, they call it the ghost that pushes you down in Cambodia. In ancient Greece, they called it Pan Ephialtes, or Pan, meaning the god Pan, who leaps upon you. They call it the Popobawa in Zanzibar, which is a giant black bat. I think Joe Nickel talked about that.
Mm-hmm.
And probably my favorite term is, in Turkey, they call it the Dark Presser. It sounds like an 80s metal band that would open up for Rat or something. And
yeah.
In Mexico, they call it a dead body that climbed on top of you. So you see, there's a lot of scary imagery in there. Mm-hmm. And it's, again, fairly universal. So the main parts are, it's a scary experience. And in most cases, you feel pressure on your chest, like something's on top of you, pressing you, attacking you, sometimes sexually assaulting you, in the case of incubi and succubi, which are these libidinal demons that were written about a lot in the Middle Ages. They would actually rape people at night.
With these historical accounts, where do they come from? Are they what is the format for the way that you've come across these examples?
Yeah, well, a lot of people have written them, and it's oftentimes termed the nightmare. The original meaning of nightmare was actually much closer to sleep paralysis than what we would consider it today, which would be just a scary dream. But back in the day, a nightmare was, you would feel paralysis, you would feel pressure on your chest, and you would feel a huge sense of dread, anxiety, angst, what have you. So that's what a nightmare originally meant. And somewhere in the 19th or the 20th century, it seems to have started shifting into just meaning a scary dream. For instance, you can find a lot of the accounts of incubi and succubi in some of the medieval texts, like the Malleus Maleficarum, the Compendium Maleficarum, which makes for some interesting reading. Contemporary accounts you can see in the UFO literature. A lot of the abductions, if you look at a lot of the narratives, the ones that happen at night at least, they sense a presence in their bedroom and they can't move. They might be being levitated vertically or horizontally, and they might have these strange beings muttering strange things and performing experiments on them. And a lot of this fits in very well with the narratives going back to fairy narratives, narratives on vampires and ghosts and werewolves and all these things. So there's a lot of overlap, but it gets culturally interpreted in a different way.
And with the alien abductions, do you find that people are encouraged to believe that this is something other than just a sleep paralysis?
Well, I think with any strange phenomenon, especially a sleep phenomenon, a lot people don't usually talk about this. I can't tell you the number of people I've interviewed that when I start asking these questions, they're like, oh my God, other people have this too? So people don't usually talk about it. And I think when you have something that you can't explain that feels real, because these dreams, they look just as real as anything you're looking at right now, except it's not there. So when people are experience this, they have to struggle to come up with, well, how do I explain this? And they use what's around them. So in the Middle Ages, when demons were talked about quite frequently, a demon could explain it. Now, that's a bit passe. Most people don't use demonology as an explanation these days, but technologically things alien.
Yeah, it depends on where you live.
Yeah, sure.
That's true.
But technologically advanced aliens or shadow people that might be interdimensional beings, that might be a little more palatable to a 21st century Westerner.
When I think of sleep paralysis, I think about incubus, succubus, and old hag. But you, in the book, you also link it to vampires, werewolves, ghosts, witches, alien abductions, and shadow people. Mm-hmm. And I would remind listeners that the tide of vampires we talked about with Richard Sugg in our vampire poltergeist episode a while back.
Sure. Well, I don't think that sleep paralysis, it's not certainly the original explanation, but I think it's a piece of the puzzle when you're trying to understand how bright people who are paying attention to their world can come up with some, from our perspective, fantastical solutions. So if you look at vampire mythology, especially the European vampires, they attack at night usually. And you hear about them glamoring, and I think they even use that term in those stupid Twilight movies, where they can paralyze you with their gaze. And interestingly, some research I've been doing lately, I've been asking people what they see when they're actually experiencing sleep paralysis. And they actually report seeing non-human beings more frequently than human beings. When they see humans, they're more likely to see strangers, but they do see people they know. And at least in a college age sample I just assessed, and I haven't published this yet, but they saw recently deceased relatives, which was kind of interesting. And if you look at some of the real vampire cases, and I use real in quotes, but the ones that were reported and people were actually accused of vampirism, the way it would start would there'd be a sickness in a village and a person would die. And then shortly thereafter, what you hear is the family report a visitation. And a guy named Barber, I can't remember his first name, but he published a book on this, and he talked about how vampirism might actually be linked with tuberculosis. Because certainly family members would be more likely to contract it if someone in their family died. And tuberculosis, interestingly enough, in the later stages, it fills your lungs with fluid and makes you secrete bloody sputum when you're coughing at night. And it makes your sleep really disturbed. So those things alone would make you much more likely to have sleep paralysis. And if in this context you were to hallucinate seeing someone in your room, and as I said before, most of these hallucinations are scary. So you see a relative in a scary context, it doesn't take much of a leap to think that, the relative attacked me, and that's why I have blood on my sheets. There's been a lot of lore about abductions. So you can see this in the fairy literature. Vampires have abducted people, and now aliens. And so one of the three types of hallucinations that you have in sleep paralysis involves movement, where your body's being moved without your volition. It might involve someone moving your arm or your leg, or it could mean actually transporting your whole body. So that's another potentially interesting connection. And again, these things feel so real from the people that report it, they can have a hard time distinguishing fact from hallucination.
Sure. I have a lot of sympathy for experiencers of these things because of my own background, and I'm sure Karen does too.
Yeah, it's something I've been experiencing of late, and I'm sure we're going to go into that shortly as well. But I just wanted to ask, why is it that sleep paralysis affects eyes and vision the way that it does, and it doesn't seem to affect hearing necessarily or other senses?
Yeah, we don't have a great answer on that, but during REM sleep, your eyes are moving. That's why they call it REM, because it's rapid eye movement. If you look at someone dreaming, you can see their eyes darting all around. So mm-hmm. It's that perseveration of REM activity into wakefulness.
Okay.
So is something going wrong in sleep paralysis? Is it pathological in some way?
It's harmless, but some people do have it, a small percentage. Of the people that have it, about 15% of those in the samples I've studied have had it to such a degree that it really interferes with their life. So that's a relatively small percentage. But yeah, your body's just not completely waking up. So there's kind of a misfiring of waking up. And so you have conscious awareness, but let me see, how to explain this. By and large, you're awake, and if you look at a cortical EEG, it's going to look like you're awake, but other parts of the brain might be asleep. It's a phenomenon called local sleep, so you can actually have parts of your brain awake and other parts asleep. But to really test that, we'd have to do some invasive subcortical EEG procedures, and that'd be... hard to do.
When you're trying to study it, are there people who consistently have it? So that you bring someone in and they'll have it every night, or enough that it makes it worthwhile to try to do a study like that?
It's pretty hard. A couple of Japanese researchers were able to do that, and they brought someone in to the lab that had sleep paralysis. Another scholar whose name is blanking on actually induced it in the lab. So what he would do, he'd have the person try to go to sleep and then wake him up right as he was trying to go to sleep several times. And that makes it more likely to have a sleep paralysis episode.
Hmm.
So do we know at all what causes sleep paralysis?
Yeah, a colleague of mine at University of Sheffield named Dan Denis just did a genetic study. So there does seem to be at least partially a genetic loading for this. A lot of behavioral factors come into play. So people that are really at risk for it are like shift workers or people that are jet lagged, anything that causes disruption or deprivation of sleep. Some other things.
This is good because when I had my incidents, I was on a 24 on 48 hour shift. So it was changing all the time.
Yeah, it's good if you want to have sleep paralysis.
I've been wondering this is a long story, so I don't want to get into all that, but basically I've been curious about what caused it, because really, realistically, like if I hadn't had sleep paralysis, we wouldn't be having this show, because I probably never would have gone down the path of getting so intensely into studying these topics, wouldn't have run into Michael Shermer's work and several other things that sort of led me out of that mode of thinking and into skepticism.
Well, I'm glad you got some sleep disruption.
Yeah. Go Navy.
Yeah. Some other things that I found out, certain types of anxiety seem to be very conducive to having sleep paralysis. So people that have what's called anxiety sensitivity, or people that get really fearful when they have anxiety-related symptoms. So if their heart starts racing, these are the people that are more likely to think they're having a heart attack. In two studies to date that I'm aware of, those people are more likely to have sleep paralysis. High levels of death anxiety is correlated with sleep paralysis. High levels of dissociation and a trauma history. So people that have PTSD, I'm not sure if it's because of the trauma or because people that have PTSD have disruptive sleep, but there does seem to be a relationship there. And one study that I know of showed that if you have a proneness to believe in the paranormal and the anomalous, you're going to be more likely to have sleep paralysis. Let me see. Other ones, having a higher BMI, body mass index.
Okay.
Being really prone to fantasy. You know, the people that are able to go in their head very deeply and when in their imagination and get really absorbed in works of art, they seem to be more prone to get sleep paralysis as well.
Okay, it's like you're reading my mind. What am I wearing?
What, what about conditions like sleep apnea or maybe having a goiter? I've always thought that those things seem to trigger sleep paralysis.
Yeah, apnea. I don't have a lot of data on this, but certainly some people I've worked with have had apnea, and that causes sleep disruption, and it's pretty scary and will lead to feelings of suffocation, especially if you don't have like a CPAP machine. So that would make you probably more likely to get it. And I should also say, if you drink alcohol before bed, what alcohol does is it acts as an REM suppressor. So you don't go into REM sleep when you're on alcohol, and then you get what's called the REM rebound effect. So you're more likely to have REM sleep later in the night than you would if you weren't drinking alcohol. So that's another thing to... There are a few simple things you can do to not have sleep paralysis. One of them is don't drink 4 hours before bed or use caffeine. Another one is just don't sleep on your back. The majority of people have sleep paralysis when they have it on their when they're sleeping in a supine position.
Wow.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's great, because my next question was going to be treatment options. When I was actually experiencing it, I tried sleeping with the lights on because I thought it was a ghost. That didn't really help much.
right?
But because ghosts are invisible, see, that's part of the
problem.
They're tricky. But no, so that's great. So I think I just sort of hit on some of – I started sleeping on my side. I don't know. That's really interesting. Okay. So I'm going to stop saying that's really interesting over and over again. We can move on with the question.
Hey, it makes me feel good, so keep it up.
And it is interesting.
Yeah, some of the early treatments are really amazing. Apart from, you know, the people that believed it was an actual attack by a demon or a ghost, they would do things to protect themselves using, like, crosses or – sleeping with an ulu, because the Inuits have a lot.
I don't know what's an ulu.
Yeah, it's a Inuit blade. It's kind of like crescent shape. They use for chopping things.
Oh, okay.
And sleeping with that on their chest. Some people have put cutting boards on their chest with an open knife so they could stab the hag if she comes to attack them. Some of the weirder ones I've seen, where was this? To protect yourself from the Mara, which is sort of this night hag thing, you would lay a towel on your chest that's streaked with human feces. Kind of gross.
I've been putting it on the wrong side. Oh my gosh. Okay. This is such a strange interview, and I apologize. Normally when we talk about these things, there are things I'm interested in, there are things I'm curious about, there are things I've read about. They're rarely things that I've experienced firsthand, and so I'm delighted to be talking about this.
Right.
So, sorry.
Yeah, it's very close to home for both of us, I think. I just had a baby 2 weeks ago, and I think a lot of the listeners are aware of that.
Congratulations. And
yeah, congratulations
again. Thank you very much. We've kind of discussed this, I guess, just in our emails over the past couple of weeks, that there are a lot of sleep disorders which are associated with pregnancy and insomnia. So is sleep paralysis something that's more common amongst pregnant women?
Yeah. Just going to a tiny bit of background, sleep paralysis is classified as a parasomnia, which is a fancy Latin word meaning alongside of sleep. So essentially, it's anything that's unwanted or distressing that occurs during, after, or when you're going into sleep. So there's a whole class of disorders like sleep paralysis, exploding head syndrome, all sorts of things. When you look at what happens during pregnancy, interestingly enough, the parasomnias seem to decrease with pregnancy, except for sleep paralysis. So during the first trimester, it has a slight reduction in the probability that you're going to get it. But for the second and third trimester, it actually ramps up. So it's unique among the parasomnias for becoming more likely, not less likely, during pregnancy. So it's perfect timing for me to come on because Karen just, you know, had a kid.
Yeah. Well, I slept really well during the first trimester, and I wonder if that has something to do with the increase in progesterone.
Could be.
Maybe in the body. But during the third trimester and just the last 2 months, I've suffered terrible insomnia. I've certainly had incidences of sleep paralysis as well. And I've been having these strange dreams where I'm dreaming that I'm unable to sleep. And then I wake up and realize I have been dreaming. So I don't know if that's some form of a sleep paralysis or what's actually taking place there, if maybe I'm sleeping very lightly.
Yeah, it's hard to say. Were you able to look around the room or were you able to sense your surroundings in the bedroom?
Oh, it's difficult to really remember exactly what was taking place. But yeah, I've certainly had a lot of sleep disturbances, and it seems to be very common amongst women during pregnancy. And you hear all kinds of claims that it's preparing you. It's an evolutionary biological thing preparing you to be wakeful when the baby needs you and when the baby's going to cry. And just so you're sleeping lightly and you'll be available for the baby. So I've heard that theory a lot.
Uh-huh.
I've just had terrible sleep problems just in the past few months.
Yeah, you're not alone. That's very, very common during pregnancy, for sure.
I know a lot of women have discomfort too, obviously, when they're at a larger size. They're unable to sleep on their stomach or on their back. And so it could just be a matter of suffering discomfort or hormones as well.
Yeah, I wish my co-author was here. He's a psychiatrist and a neurologist, so he could get more into that piece of it than me, unfortunately.
Oh, yeah. That was one of the questions I wanted to ask. Was, who is he and what's his background? How did you guys hook up to work on this?
His name's Carl Doug Ramji. He's a much more senior person than me. He's a professor of psychiatry, medicine, and neurology at Thomas Jefferson University. He's a great guy. He actually did analytic training at the analytic center where I did a fellowship, and I had heard of him. And so when I was coming up with plans for the book, I wanted to have an MD, and I'd take sort of the psychology of it and the history of it. And so I contacted him, we hit it off, and we had some really fun conversations, and we decided to write the book together. And Oxford University Press fortunately let us do it.
That's a great concept for a book. Someone had to write it.
Yeah.
I'm very curious about the sort of opposite of sleep paralysis, which are I've read about people who are not inhibited in their movement when they sleep. I've read some interesting but really horrific stories about people committing crimes in this kind of a mental state. Have you looked into that much?
I haven't done a lot of study about it. I'm aware of it.
Yeah,
it's you can have people that are doing really effortful, elaborate movements like cooking. I've heard of cases of people driving. You've got another disorder that's causing some interesting legal arguments called sexsomnia. And this is where people are actually having full-on sexual intercourse while they're sleeping. And they have no memory when they wake that they just had sex.
And yeah.
At the time, I saw
a legal case where a guy apparently woke up mid-coitus with an underage girl who says he had no idea how that happened. So he actually called the police and turned himself in. There, it is a lot of legal questions about when are you in control of your actions.
Yeah, there's actually a chapter in my new book that I'm about halfway done with. It's an edited book where Elena Del Busto is writing a chapter on sexsomnia, and she's actually been involved in the forensic aspects of it. So it's very interesting stuff, and it's clearly going to make judges and lawyers' lives fairly complicated to try and sort out what's going on.
Does it suggest that consciousness is in some ways more about constructing narrative than actually constructive volition, at least some of the time?
Boy, that's a deep question.
That's what the show's all about, you know?
Yeah. I mean, you think about sort of conscious awareness with wakefulness, which is one of only three human states. Then you've got REM sleep and non-REM sleep along with the
What's that when I'm standing in the kitchen before I've actually drank my coffee, but I've made it downstairs? What's that state?
That's for the zombie show.
Yeah, okay.
Oh, yeah, that's the fourth state.
Zuvendis.
Well, it was my understanding that people who do things like cooking and eating and driving and having sex in their sleep, that was related somehow to the use of sedatives. Is that the case?
I've heard of that with...
Ambien and other drugs.
Yeah, I actually know some... I've heard of some students that will actually try to stay up on Ambien and try to have sex on it. And it's supposed to, I guess, intensify it. I don't know why sex isn't enough, but... Yeah. And there was an episode of Rescue Me where one of the firemen in that show did that, and he was going around and doing really bizarre things. And it was kind of like he's in a walking blackout where he only had the ability to encode about a minute or two of memories, and that was all gone. Mm. So, yeah, but not sure.
Was it Emo Phillips who said, he said, I thought the brain was the most interesting part of my body, and then I realized, what's making me think that? But I do find it completely fascinating because everybody during their life performs so many things, and they have these plans, these hopes, these dreams, and then a little bit of damage to the brain, and suddenly they're a different person. And, mm-hmm. and as a... I guess a materialist, I believe in that there's biological reasons for all the things that happen in our experiences. I'm just fascinated by the complexity and the fragility of the human brain and the human experience that comes out of that.
Oh, yeah.
So in your career, how did you select this as a career? And how is that does that drive your continued interest?
I actually looked back in my yearbook. I wrote that I wanted to be a clinical psychologist when I was in high school. So I've wanted to be a clinical psychologist for just about as long as I can remember. I originally wanted to be an archaeologist, but then I found out Indiana Jones was just a movie and they really didn't get to do all that stuff. So then I kind of, when you're looking at pottery shards all day, I kind of lose interest for me.
Yeah. It's much more exciting to be a looter. What?
Yeah, right. So I was really just fascinated to figure out people, why they do the things that they do. And when I work with patients, it's amazing. People pay me to tell me their deepest secrets and to look at themselves in ways they've never looked before. I mean, how freaking cool is that?
It is pretty cool. Now, let's talk about the deepest secrets now. No.
It is kind of like being a Scientologist.
Ah, no, my
auditing
gosh.
People, hey?
Right. I need my e-meter.
But in all seriousness, so you're dealing with the clinical side. Do you feel like you're able to help? I mean, how's that work? I mean, like, how
with
do you measure your
general?
Success from with a patient?
With patients in general or with sleep paralysis?
Well, no, with patients in general. I was just kind of curious about that as a career choice. You know, a lot of people who listen to the show are younger and are trying to decide what to do with their lives. So when we can, I like to ask people about, you know, how they pick their career and if people want to get into that sort of field. And so in this particular sense, the reason I'm asking is because I'm curious as to how rewarding is it to be able to help someone and how frustrating is it when you can't help them? Mm-hmm. What's that like?
I've got a really great job, and clinical work is only one part of it. So one of the reasons I like my field is I get to do research, I get to write, I get to teach, work with students, I get to run a clinic, and I get to see patients. So I get to do lots of different things throughout the day. And yeah, I love clinical work. It's kind of like that old joke, how many psychologists does it take to screw in a light bulb, to change a light bulb?
Yeah, it's a different answer. Yeah.
It's one, but the light bulb has to want to change.
Exactly.
So if you have a patient that's really they don't have to be insightful, but if they're willing to try to be insightful and look at themselves and try new things and experiment and try to break themselves out of those habitual patterns they get into that inevitably leave them to misery, it's fantastic. When you're working with patients that don't want to be there or that don't really have much motivation, then it's certainly less rewarding. But I like all my patients now, and it's nice to see progress. It's not as quick as, you know, giving someone a pill maybe, but if you look at some of the outcome literature, it seems like there's some evidence that the changes made in psychotherapy are more long-lasting than those made from SSRIs.
Sure.
That's interesting.
So I love my job, and it's like anything else. You can have parts of it that are annoying, but by and large, I mean, I get to see patients, I get to talk to really interesting people, I get to write this book. I mean, I got paid to read 15th century witchcraft manuals for 2 weeks.
That's nice.
that's cool.
I had to buy my own copy and didn't get a penny for it. What? Well, you read the 1970s translation, is that right? I think that's what I saw.
The Malayas?
Yes, yeah.
The Montague Summers one.
Oh, you read the Summers one. Okay, that's the one I was reading too. Okay, yeah. I found that whole book fascinating because it seemed to me that it was like such a nerdy book, and I didn't expect to run into that level of, I mean, I can't, it's witch nerds. I don't know what else to call it. I mean, it's got all these Bible trivia. I mean, there's so much argumentation about the most nuanced questions. Did I just say?
Can incubi impregnate human women?
Yes. I mean,
like 30 pages or something.
It's not whether is it real or is it not. It's like, well, is Satan allowed to actually create anything? You know, and that would be, you know, is Satan empowered with the ability to make life? You know, it's really interesting.
These guys were working in a paradigm. It was like what Thomas Kuhn would call normal science. They're taking all the presuppositions for granted and they're working on fine tuning things. So,
exactly.
Okay, well, can incubi impregnate human women? Well, not by themselves, but if they act like a succubi first and extract sperm from one person and then go and find a woman and then they turn into a male incubus and then they can impregnate that way, but they can't on their own. So they spent, I think, 20 pages on that.
It makes
sense.
Lengthy. Yeah, exactly. But it reminds me very much of the same sort of thing that happens in Bigfoot studies, where you have people – it's not a question of whether Bigfoot's real for these people. It's like, what's his favorite way to catch food?
Just accept it as a given, like, that he exists.
Exactly. That's a presupposition, and then everything else is about – speculation about, you know, is he attracted to women researchers more than men? You know, like, is it better to have menstruation? Does he like bananas? You know, I don't want to say crazy because it's not crazy, and that's a very loaded word, but it is, I think, misguided. Although it does seem to maintain some kind of internal logic.
But it's a lot of fun to talk about. All of us are skeptics, but all of us, I'm sure, at some point in their lives were pretty entranced with this stuff.
Oh, yes. Indeed. Yeah.
I mean, as long as we can all agree that Bigfoot's favorite Slurpee is Kiwi Cherry.
I'm not sure about that.
Hey, heretic.
Heretic.
Well, I wanted to ask you, Brian, as a personal question, so I guess you don't need to answer it if you don't want to. But
have I'm an open book, Karen.
Oh, excellent. Have you actually experienced sleep paralysis yourself or any of these kinds of sleep disturbances?
It's so funny because most psychological research is really me-search. I have actually never experienced it. I've been waiting.
Really?
And I've been studying this since, I guess I started when I was on postdoc in 2008, and I have yet to experience it. And another disorder I study called exploding head syndrome, I've never experienced that either.
What is that exactly?
Yeah. That, exploding head syndrome, well, that's the colorful term for what happens when you're going to sleep and you're suddenly awakened by a loud noise. It's not like a normal loud noise, though. It sounds like a bomb going off or a gun being fired next to or even inside of your head. So that's another one of these transition experiences, kind of like sleep paralysis. And I've worked with some people that have had up to 7 times a night.
Oh.
And that has its own kind of connection with anomalous thoughts. I've gotten a number of emails, and there seems to be a connection of working this into conspiracy theories. So even if people know that there's such a thing called exploding head syndrome, they think that's what's causing it isn't just your brain misfiring, but it's a government agent using a directed energy weapon,
or it could
be those new utility monitoring systems that are active. I just got a call from a woman who was very upset last week who wanted to tell me that it was caused by that, you know, or cell phones. So people are being tormented. They call themselves targeted individuals,
wow.
TIs.
Wow.
And how
do you deal with those people?
Well, I haven't worked with any clinically. I mean, they would be very much not inclined to come into psychotherapy because it's not, the problem's out in the world, not there.
Yes.
So, yeah. But exploding head syndrome, there's not much treatment data out there, but some antidepressants might be useful. Any convulsants and calcium channel blockers, there's some case studies that show they might work. But by and large, just telling people, hey, this is a thing called exploding head syndrome. It's not dangerous. There's nothing wrong with you, and a lot of people have it. That alone has been shown to reduce the frequency of episodes.
So, this is interesting to me. The people, humans in general, are always looking for meaning and patterns. And I think, you know, Michael Shermer
talks about
patternicity. But the average person goes out into the world and they're able to function just fine, whether or not they're a critical thinker or not, because generally, even if you have a bad pattern, like you believe, like people, gamblers, for example, who are heavy gamblers and believe they know how to work the system or whatever, you know, that they know what's lucky, you know, that it's not true, but they survive just fine. Right. But, you know, in my line of work, and I guess it's not exactly science, but in IT troubleshooting sort of scenarios, you've got to be able to eliminate what's not true from what is true, or you'll never solve the problems, whatever they may be.
Sure.
Right. So you have to have some sort of methodical, logical approach. But I know that many people can get by without that. So in this sleep paralysis scenario, in all these cultures, there seems to be these common themes of believing that a creature or an entity is getting on top of you. Now, I, as an experiencer, I know what that's like. Uh-huh. I didn't have any visual component. I just felt something on top of me. And it felt very much like a person had crawled on top of me and was attacking me in some way.
Yeah, that's very common.
But why do we have this common visual component that it's a humanoid of some sort that's doing it? That I find that fascinating, that even though there is nothing there, that's what keeps coming up. What do you think is going on there?
Well, what's interesting is there's a progression to the experience. And there's not a lot of scientific literature on this, but there's a bit. So there seems to be a sequence where you first sense that there's a presence in the room with you. It's kind of like when you're walking in the woods at night or down, you know, an alley in Philadelphia at night, and you have the sense that there's somebody watching you or that you're prey as opposed to predator. And then that leads you to feel fear. And then what happens next is you will see something, because I think your brain's trying to organize, well, okay, I'm getting the sensation of fear and that something's here. what is it? There's nothing there. So it organizes it, and it uses the categories that are around you. So if you're in 15th century France, you might think it's a werewolf or a demon. If you're in the States now, you might think it's a shadow person. So it goes from being sensed to seen and then felt. So usually it starts out shadowy, and you might just hear strange sounds, clawing, noises on the floor, or just muttering, and then it comes towards you, and then it comes on top of you and might start attacking you or raping you. So that seems to be the sequence in how people report it.
Wow, I feel lucky to have avoided some of that.
Oh yeah, it's really terrifying for people.
Oh, it is. I mean, it was life changing.
I mean, I have a lot of sympathy for them, and it makes sense that some people will have some problems differentiating the hallucination from reality. Especially, could you imagine if you're seeing someone you know?
No,
it'd be terrifying.
It would be terrifying.
Yeah,
most people I know would scare the hell out of me. So
right.
So what about in the cases where people are seeing someone who's recently died? Is there still a component of suffocation or some idea that someone's climbing on top of them, or is it more just a vision that they have?
All of the above. They really run the gamut. But okay. What's strange, I've talked to a few people. I did a study with a large sample of college students, and a lot of them just experienced their first death with their grandparents. Mm-hmm. And so I can remember a few cases where they talked about having great relationships with their grandparents, and then they're worked into the sleep paralysis hallucination, and they're saying really terrible things to them, or they're attacking them. Uh-huh. One case had that I interviewed, she had a boyfriend, and her boyfriend was in the hallucination. It was just saying the most hurtful things to her, and she was, even when she was describing it in session, she was crying and she was so upset by it. She realized that it wasn't her boyfriend, but you can imagine if you have certain psychological conditions that might make reality, consensual reality, a bit more tenuous, that it could be easier to believe, well, that really happened.
Mm-hmm. Or that was a demonic attack.
Exactly.
Yeah. So that must be truly terrifying to someone who has that sort of worldview. If they have the expectation that there are such things as aliens or demons or old hags. If I'd had my preference, I would have loved to have been attacked by someone very attractive. You know, all the pictures I've seen of succubuses are just adorable. I can't. It's like that, never had that. But it was terrifying, and it lasted. There were only a couple of incidents I can clearly recall, but the fear lasted for 4 or 5 years. And really. So I mean, I didn't know what had happened. So my sleep ritual, I got a dog, and you know, because I thought that dogs might be able to see the ghosts and keep them away, and I slept with the lights on. I had a smudging ceremony. I had prayers. I had tried to get a priest to come over.
Wow. So this really impacted on your life in
It was quite serious. Yeah, I'll tell you the most. This is amusing to me now. But I had an incident when I had come back to the States. I had been stationed in the Middle East for about a year and a half, and I came back to the States because my grandfather was having a health crisis and was really pretty close to dying. And while I was on the way back to the Middle East, I got stuck in Philadelphia for a week waiting for a military flight. And I was staying at an inexpensive motel near the airport, the kind that a sailor could afford.
Right.
The kind that when you go in, if it's after like 6 or 7 o'clock, everybody's behind bulletproof glass, you know?
Yeah, I was at UPenn for 5 years. I know Philly very well, and I'm glad I'm not in Philly anymore.
I mean, there was parts of Philly I loved, but that wasn't one
Me
of
too,
them.
Me too.
So, yeah. But I woke up after having a sleep paralysis. I felt like there was somebody had attacked me. I'd had the lights on. When I woke up, there was nobody there, but I clearly could sense that I was being attacked, right? There was somebody on top of me trying to hold me down, you know? Sure. So when I was able to get control of my body again, I ran outside in my pajamas to the clerk and said, you know, this is brilliant, right? Did somebody die in my room?
And oh, poor Blake.
The clerk looks at me and says, do I need to call the police?
Oh.
And I'm like, no. is there a reason there would be a ghost in my room?
Oh.
And then the guy looked at me and says, do I need to call the police? I said, no, I'm going to go back to my room now. And so I went back to my room, and after a long, long, long while, I finally get back to sleep. But it impacted me very negatively, I would say. So, yeah.
Go ahead, Karen. Sorry.
Oh, I was just going to say, I could see how this could really affect someone's quality of life.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't sleep with the eye mask on or anything. I just tried to sleep with the lights on. That's not really good for your sleep. So.
No. Sure.
Anyway, one evening, I was watching a documentary, and Michael Shermer came on and just started talking about sleep paralysis, and my jaw dropped. I mean, I was like, what? You know?
Yeah.
Because I had done plenty of reading about ghosts and old hags and incubus and succubus and all these other phenomena, but none of them ever mentioned sleep paralysis as a possible cause. So getting an introduction to the skeptical literature on the matter was hugely important to me. So.
Yeah, you're certainly not alone. But again, you know, given how terrified you were, you can imagine. I know you told the guy at the front desk, but a lot of people will really keep those things to themselves, and they think they're going crazy. Mm-hmm. A lot of people fear that the paralysis is going to be permanent, too.
Oh, wow.
So while they're there, they think, oh, my God, I'm not going to be able to move again. I'm going to die here if nobody's checking on me.
That's frightening.
And then what I'm really fascinated by, it sounds like you guys are too, but I'm fascinated by people who are otherwise, you know, they're normal, but they've got this kind of one pocket of strange belief.
Yes.
So like if you look at the abductee literature, the abductees, the literature says that they're no more likely to have mental health disorders than anybody else. Which is interesting, and I think a lot of people would be surprised by that, but they're not. But they have one kind of unusual pocket of belief. So they vary a little bit on other things. So they might perform differently on they might report higher levels of dissociation or magical ideation, and there's an inconsistent literature on they may be more likely to develop false memories, but there's Rich McNally and Susan Clancy did a really interesting study using the Diess-Rüdiger-McDermott paradigm, which is where you give people a list of words, like, say, candy, sugar, gumballs, but you don't say sweet. Right. And what you do is you ask them, did you report this word? And people in their study were more likely to say that sweet was really a word than people who didn't believe they were abducted by aliens. But colleague Chris French tried to replicate it, and it didn't work.
We know Chris French.
He's a great guy. But it's a little bit of a different memory task, because misremembering a word is very different from misremembering an entire narrative. So there could be a different memorial process going on. But it's really fascinating that – and then you've got people that have conspiracy theories, some of them fairly elaborate, but are otherwise, you know, normal people. It's really fascinating. And I think all of us probably have – little strange beliefs that other people might not share, but we're able to function just fine.
Well, yeah.
I think even skeptics have that blind spot, and I think Penn Jillett has referred to that as a gree-gree, just that kind of weird little belief that even skeptics have.
Well, I read Dan Ariely's work, Behavioral Economics, right? And there's so much interesting stuff there about how people may think they're being rational and they're not. And so I believe the most likely explanation is we are rational enough to get by, and that everything else is an illusion. That, you know, we get by. We're good enough at rationality to have discovered lots of really cool applications for it and ways to look at things in retrospect. But when it comes to actually taking action and forming beliefs, the irrationality is always going to be there, no matter how much we try to account for it.
Yep, and that's probably for the best. I don't think we can be completely rational. I don't think
it would be any fun.
Problems.
I mean,
when I
come home,
Freud was all about conflict. Right. I got to go with him on this.
Where's the passion, right?
Yep.
Well, I've just got another question about sleep paralysis, I guess, for both of you, too. For you, Blake, as an experiencer, and for you, Brian, as just cataloging other people's experiences. is there any kind of repetition in the way that people suffer sleep paralysis if they get it on a chronic level? So will they be seeing the same creatures or the same things and having the same experiences again and again, like having that one dream that you have all the time? Or each time, is it a unique thing that you're experiencing?
In the case of my experiences, and I can only speak from my own personal experience, there was no visual component. So in all the ones that I recall, now something happened to me when I was about six, where I saw something that I would now call a shadow person. And in that particular case, I think there was sleep paralysis with it. But I've read enough of Elizabeth Loftus's research that I don't really trust my memories. But I do recall seeing a shadowy person at the foot of my bed, and I thought it was my father. And I asked him if I could get a drink of water, and then he didn't reply. And I kept asking him, and then I get more and more alarmed, and then eventually called for. Started screaming, basically. And then he came into the room and the lights turned on and there was nobody there. And that's the only time that's ever happened. But when I heard about shadow people years later, I was like, oh, I know what they're talking about. I remember this distinct memory of this shadowy figure that looked in the outline like a person, but there was nothing really there. But all the other things I experienced as an adult were just the sensation of something. I felt a pressure sort of creeping up my chest and then I was unable to move. And of course, the funny thing is, at the time, I didn't even remember having fallen asleep. So I don't know how long it was between the time that I actually fell asleep and then this happened. But, working the shifts that I was working at the time, getting in bed was falling asleep as far as I was concerned. I mean, I was so tired by the time I got to bed.
Sure.
But it was the same experience, and it was completely terrifying because I felt like someone had physical access to my body whenever they wanted it, and I had no control over it. Yeah,
that's frightening.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, I'm sure you've researched and have much more interesting visual stories, and can tell me whether there's a pattern or not, or answer Karen's question better.
So. It seems to be a bit all over the place. There does seem to be some degree of inter-episode consistency in terms of what they're having. So they might have the same types of symptoms like the suffocation. They might feel cold. They might have visual hallucinations. Some people have the same visual hallucinations. Other people, it seems to vary. But there does seem to be some consistency overall to the general gist of what they're experiencing.
Okay.
And if you have a strong belief in these paranormal events, you would think that your brain would be more likely to organize it in that frame. Mm-hmm. As far as scary stories, I've heard quite a bit. I know a clinical psychologist who reported essentially having a woman that looked like a witch in her 70s or 80s on top of him, raping him.
Mm.
That's pretty scary. Another person had a little vampire girl, and this vampire, she was a student sleeping on top of bunks, and she saw the vampire girl with blood on her teeth, and she kept grabbing her leg and clawing and scratching at her and trying to get at her and telling her she was going to drag her to hell.
So
sleep paralysis, the episodes last around 6 minutes. That's the mean. They can last shorter or longer, but the data says around 6 minutes. So that's a scary 6 minutes when you've got a vampire girl saying creepy things to you.
Because you feel the sensations. I mean, it's not like later you remember. It's like it's happening to you.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, it's really messed up.
And then they disappear.
Isn't that right, exactly. They're gone, and you've got nothing to show for it. I mean, I think I've already shared my the first time it happened to me. I was in the Navy active duty. I was in the Middle East. I was alone in a locked apartment, and I thought someone. I mean, I didn't think supernatural the first time. I thought somebody had broken into my apartment. I thought I was being attacked by an invader, like somebody it was just attacking the American sailor, and. And so when I realized there was nobody there, I went ahead and called into base to report it because I didn't know what else to do with it. And the person who took the call asked me, what are they supposed to do about it? Did they want me to send? I was in the police force. Did they want to send a truck over? No. did they want me to put in the logbook that Petty Officer Smith saw a ghost? No. There was really no
Dan Aykroyd and Bill Murray.
I had no actions. I had no remedies. I had no methodology for fixing it. So it was very odd. Sure. So yeah,
it's scary stuff, and it's so strange. And just you were talking about how suddenly it goes away. If you look back at the vampire mythology, you know, vampires would disappear when cocks crow. At cockscrow. And if you would wake up and move, they would disappear. If you touch them, they would disappear in some of the myths. So it's really fascinating. And then you got the weird stuff I just don't understand. So as I was researching this and looking at some of the mythology, it seems like vampires and witches, in the southern U.S. there were myths about this, and in France as well. But if you scatter millet or rice or seeds, vampires and witches would obsessively have to count them before they could attack you. Uh-huh. So they have crippling arithmomania, which is the fancy term for obsessive counting.
Yeah, so yeah, exactly. I've always thought that was cool because they finally included that on the X-Files, one of their vampire episodes. I don't know if it was rice or salt he threw down, and the vampire had to stop and count. It was like really mad. I was like, I love that, because I always found that a fascinating aspect of vampire lore that's rarely included in modern stories.
Yeah, but it doesn't make much sense. Like, why would they be compelled to do that? But yeah, so but that's, I guess it's a way to make you feel that you have some way of protecting yourself, maybe.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
or because vampires have OCD and they're real, maybe.
Yeah, could be.
It's possible could be. Too. But yeah, it's a fascinating topic in general, and it just sounds like you've got a great lifetime ahead of you of just researching this. So many stories.
Oh, there are plenty of those, and I get quite a number of emails from people with this and exploding head syndrome every week, and I answer them all. They're really interesting, and you know, but you hear some doozies for sure.
Well, we're,
and it's nice to get the word out. There's going to be a movie coming out on this. Do you guys know Rodney Asher?
No.
No.
He's the documentary filmmaker that did Room 237.
Oh, okay. I haven't watched that yet, but I've heard so many good things about it. So,
yeah, he just directed a movie called The Nightmare that I think it's premiering next week. But it goes through and follows eight people with sleep paralysis, and they go into it. And it's kind of like a horror documentary. I haven't seen it yet, but I'm going to write a review for Oxford University Press. They do a blog, so I'm going to try and see it. And
excellent.
See what it's like to get a vivid, you know, documentary portrayal of it.
But I guess we should close with our final question. And Brian, you've been a listener for quite some time, so you know what I'm about to ask. What's your favorite monster?
Yeah, I knew you were going to ask, and I was really torn. I'll tell you two. I think I will choose one, though. But I really like the Ahul, the giant bat.
Mm-hmm.
But I think my favorite one's got to be the giant octopus. When I was a little kid, I remember seeing that Dennis de Montfort engraving of the giant kraken attacking the ship.
Sure.
I actually got a poster sized and framing of that. It's hanging in my bedroom right now.
Nice.
And I love octopi. They're really smart. They're cute. And the idea that there are just giant ones out there roaming about is just fantastic. I hope they're real, but.
Oh, well, I mean, they are. I don't know if they're quite to that scale.
Well, we have the giant Pacifics and right outside of Seattle, but yeah.
So you know, it's interesting that that's one of the two topics I've had the most trouble finding the right guest to come on. And one is giant snakes, and the other is the Kraken. And we had a guy talk about the Kraken who was a really interesting character. Unfortunately, we lost the episode. The episode, like, nobody's recording worked. So yeah. I want to redo that. And I actually, after watching Arthur C. Clarke's series, I got a little collection of his discs, and he did these shows back in the early 80s where they were skeptical, but they had fantastic access to a lot of the people who were reporting the phenomena that were being dealt with. The phenomena that were being dealt with, because there's multiples, right? and one of the episodes was talked about a giant squid, and they cover some really interesting aspects of those about people who reported being attacked and a ship that was attacked by a biological entity of some sort. Mm-hmm. And I really want to get somebody on who can address those particular incidents as well as the actual biology of these magnificent creatures of the sea. So
Giant squid, they have a specimen at the Smithsonian. I wonder if one of those folks might be able to do it.
You know, it's been interesting because I've been in conversation with several people. But there's people who study them and and research them, but I haven't found anybody who's willing to come talk, and that's been the challenge. So I'll keep approaching it. But I've had conversations. It's not like I can't identify humans. It's that they don't want to talk, especially the giant snake. My gosh, herpetologists are just the most cold and reclusive. No, I don't know. They just even before the show started, I was trying to get a guest to talk about that, because especially because Titanoboa in particular, you know, the biggest snake we know of, and while it's a fascinating topic and lots of people are interested in it, I just haven't been able to get anybody to come on the show.
We'll find someone eventually.
It shall happen. Mm-hmm. So anyway, well, thank you again, Brian, for spending some time with us.
Thank you, Brian. It's been fun. Happy 99th.
Yeah, thank you.
Monster Talk.
Thanks for listening to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm your host, Blake Smith. Today, you heard Karen Stolzno and I interview Dr. Brian Sharpless about his new book on sleep paralysis. A link to his book and to some discount codes for use in the U.S. and the U.K. are in our show notes at monstertalk.org. As Brian mentioned, this is episode 99. The next episode is our 100th, and I want to say thanks again to all of you who have sent in contributions for that special show. Monster Talk is an official podcast of Skeptic Magazine. The opinions expressed on this show are those of myself and my guests and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Skeptic Magazine or the Skeptic Society. Although, I'm sure they do occasionally make Michael Shermer sit up with a start and wonder, was it all a dream? Monster Talk theme music is by Peach Stealing Monkeys. Thank you again for listening.
For more skepticism? Want to learn the truth about the scientific controversies of our time? Then subscribe to Skeptic, the quarterly magazine Stephen Jay Gould called the best journal in the field. To subscribe, visit skeptic.com today.
Thanks for being here.
Yeah, no kidding. Yeah. Not like all those people that didn't show up for... No.
Exactly. Damn. You're getting to the bottom of the barrel now.
No, this is great.